Hello, and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We've got something really interesting for you today. Basically, thanks to Lockie, who introduced us to this lady, Alina's got a new soulmate.
I do, very much so. We have with us today, and being a little somber because it is a somber subject, we've got with us Elizabeth Mason, who's a historian and sociologist specializing in trauma, genocide, and terrorism. And today we're actually going to talk about genocide in film, which is really interesting. I'm really looking forward to this conversation, see where it goes.
Lizzie,
Welcome.
hi.
I'm good. Thank you, girls, for having me. I've been excited about this also for a while.
Yeah, this is you two get each other. You two get going out to dinner with a guy on a first date and then going, "What do you do for a living?" And you going, "Please don't make me tell you. You'll never call me again." Boom.
Yes, I've had that one too, way too many times. Or they get really interested, and then after like 5 minutes, they get bored.
Lizzie, we're going to talk about films and genocide on film and how genocide is represented. Just briefly tell everybody how you came to this subject and what your academic interest is. How do you know this stuff?
Well, I think it was kind of a roundabout way that I became an academic that kind of deals with this subject as one of a couple of disciplines that I work with. Really, my earliest experience with the discussion of genocide was a fantastic class that was taught at a university called St. Lawrence University in New York State. I was taught by a fantastic man called Alun Gabriel, who specializes actually in German resistance movements during the period of World War II, during, of course, the Nazi era. And my first class was an introduction to genocide. I became very passionate about the topic. I remember specifically a discussion with a man who became my mentor, Alun Gabriel, and discussing that I would like to work in history. I would like to become an academic. And I said, particularly to him, that I could not work in this field. I could not deal with this subject matter. There, of course, became a large arc in my own life. I'm German American. I have one parent who's American, one parent who's German. My German family was involved in National Socialism. The city I'm from is the city of Coburg. It is the first city that elected a National Socialist mayor. So someone who was a member of the National Socialist Party. Our Duke, the Duke of Coburg, who of course is a descendant of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert of the
Indeed.
House of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, that was Karl Emanuel. Duke Karl Emanuel was particularly connected with Adolf Hitler. He indeed was one of many royals in Germany who believed that if they allied themselves with Adolf Hitler, that he would restore everything that they
Way
lost.
back.
Indeed, at the end of
Yeah.
World War
Well,
One.
even the Kaiser was dabbling with that up until the time he died, wasn't he? Like, he didn't he veer between hating Hitler and hoping Hitler would get him his throne back?
Absolutely. And of course, Crown Prince Wilhelm indeed was particularly connected with Adolf Hitler for that reason.
Yeah. My latest research subject is the Duke of Windsor, so let's not even go there.
Well, we could, but another podcast. But anyway, Karl Emanuel was particularly involved in something called the T4 program, the Tiergartenstrasse 4 program, where he was on the committee that oversaw the forced extermination of persons who were physically and mentally disabled in Germany. My city of Coburg had roughly 300 Jewish people. Naturally, before 1939, there was not one Jewish person that remains in the city of Coburg. My opa, my grandfather, was indeed a member of the Hitler Youth. Another member of my family, the father of my grandmother, was deported, believed to be a member of the National Socialist Party, and was a train master in the region of northeastern Bavaria, and was deported by the Russians. So this became a family exploration, of course. What did it mean to be German? What did it mean to have family history involved in National Socialism? And who had arguable ties with the mechanisms, if not the social mechanisms that, of course, allowed the Holocaust to take place. That brought me to move to Germany in some ways to explore being German. And I guess in a really roundabout way, I came back to this history. I figured out that this was something I could talk about in ways that other people could not. This then led me to try to understand what it meant to perpetrate these crimes, and how an individual can become so separated from society, so separated from humanity, so separated from empathy, that this became something uniquely that I became adept in talking about. What does it mean to be on the wrong side of genocide? What does it mean to be on the wrong side of acts that we now call terrorism? What does it mean to be on the wrong side of acts that we now call war crimes?
This is the thing, isn't it? It's like we can remember those who perished and those who suffered, and give them back their voices. But how do you stop it happening again if you don't understand why people carried it out in the first place?
Yeah. So that is what I do.
Okay, well, so specifically today, we're going to talk about how genocide is represented on film. And you've given us a number of, I think we've got 7 films to look at, and they cover 5 different cases of genocide. I want to start with the one that I think is going to turn out to be a really interesting discussion. I mean, we've got at least 2 films that cover the Rwanda genocide. And this is the only bit of levity in the whole of this. When we were dividing up the films between Alina and I to watch, I wouldn't touch these with a barge pole because I went to Kigali in 2019. And the one day I spent at the genocide memorial was enough for me. I actually can't hack it. So Alina picked these up. And being a donut she is, has been watching them before bedtime. So the first film, Hotel Rwanda.
Well, I feel like Hotel Rwanda, it was really, when it was released in 2004, so conveniently also 10 years after the genocide began, very much brought this subject to the mainstream media. Now, in my opinion, there's several films that we're kind of talking about today that have their limitations. So of course, any Hollywood, any cinematic depiction of inherently what are the worst periods of humanity in the modern era, naturally can go so far. So Hotel Rwanda, I share with Alina that I bawled my eyes out the first time I saw this film, and it still remains one of the most iconic depictions of the Rwandan genocide that we have. Personally, I find Hotel Rwanda and several of the counterparts we're going to be discussing today interesting rewatching them for the first time. I watched them, which was probably about 10 years ago, and watching them today, in that really it depicts stories of a group of people that survived, in the Hotel de Mille Collines, and managed to come out of this experience. And the limitations very much to these kind of films is that, first of all, expected of a Hollywood narrative is a certain character progression, is a certain ending, you know, something that comes to a particular end point to conclude the film with. Now, of course, what this inherently lacks is the after. And of course, especially in the Rwandan case, in the case of, let's say, for example, the Holocaust as well, we can definitely say that there is a history that exists after this, not only personally for the individuals that survive, or even the individuals that perish in these periods, but very much also what happens emotionally, either individually or collectively, to a group of people that survive such traumatic events. And I think that's something that rewatching, for example, Hotel Rwanda, rewatching Sometimes in April, which are the 2 films that I've chosen that are the most well-known depictions, in my opinion, of the Rwandan genocide. Very much it's this point of what is next, what happens to survivors next, to Rwanda as a country next, is something very much that Hotel Rwanda misses, and even to a point that sometimes in April does not conclude with or cover in these narratives.
I found that really interesting. And sometimes in April, you start the film off. And by the way, this is the first time I've dipped my toe in this genocide, and it is so. It blew my mind that I was eight years old when this was happening. So obviously we didn't know what was happening left or right. But it's like what 20 years ago,
almost
20 years ago. It brings it home. And I sat and I watched this, and it starts off with Idris Elba, who's a teacher. And it's really interesting watching, you start with the aftermath first. So they kind of gently bring you into the genocide, and it's very easy. And you're thinking, oh, okay, this is going to be all right. And then it just goes just completely and utterly dark. And you're watching these people go from safety, feeling good, feeling okay, even though his wife has been saying to him, his wife says, come on, we should have left. We should have left by now. And I'm sitting there thinking, yes, you should have left. Why did you not leave? You could have left by now. It brings up, this film brought up so many emotions that I didn't know if I was going left, right, up, down, or round and round.
So just some background like on the Rwandan genocide. I think in that case, it sounds to me, because I didn't watch this one, I had like a really horrible moment at the memorial, and I cannot get this image of this little girl out of my head whose picture is on the wall and under all of the, they have a children's room where they have all the pictures up. And I've told this story on this podcast before, and it's like she's up there and it says like name, age, and it'll tell you what happened. And under what happened, it just says a soldier repeatedly smashed her head off a wall till she died. And this to me then says that film gets it, the Rwanda genocide, because it's just this sudden explosion of mass violence, effectively out of like, and the scale at which it reached, Lizzie, is just like, there is no way to rectify it in your head, is there?
No, I think certainly when someone mentions the word genocide, we of course I hope it's not talked about before in anyone's education. Genocide brings about this image of mass death. It's not serial murders. It's not, for example, 1, 2, 3 people being murdered. It is a scale that is indeed incomprehensible. And certainly with the Rwandan genocide, it is a scale that, as far as documentation shows, goes beyond anything that we can possibly imagine. We are talking in a tremendously short period of time. We are talking 900,000, possibly more people being viscerally annihilated, and in a very physical, in a very direct way.
I mean, this girl I mentioned was 2 years old, 2 or 3 exactly. years old at most. And that's the difference, I think, probably why it blew Alina's mind, is it's not like the Holocaust. It's not years and years of build-up and exactly. planning, and it's people on people. It's not some big bad Reich doing it and planning it.
You know what really got me? And I laid in bed at night and I laid into the early hours and thought about this quite a lot. Now, it was the Hutu and the Tutsi, and the film underlines at the beginning, they had similar culture, religion, backgrounds. They were basically more or less, you could say, borderline the same. And I'm sitting there thinking, going, wow, okay. So if you compare what I study and you think, okay, Poland, similar to Czech, similar to Slovak, that is like the Poles going in and massacring the Slovaks, or the Slovaks massacring the Poles. And it's just, I just can't imagine that actually happening. Brother killing brother, sister killing sister. There was no filter, absolutely nothing.
I mean, you drive down, we traveled by road in Rwanda, and we were doing the guerrilla thing, and I was happy to do it and happy to pay like the premium that you pay to go and see the gorillas in the wild, because the money goes into Rwanda. And it is, you pass the mass graves and you drive past them on, and it's like, when we drive around the Western Front and you spot the war cemeteries, it's like you spot the genocide cemeteries. and it's like they still live with it every day. And actually, so we mentioned this, didn't we? Or we have mentioned it on another podcast, and I can't remember what order they're going out in. The fact that this led to Rwanda being the only country ever asking to join the Commonwealth. So you have all these, everyone in Rwanda walking around with a French name of a certain age, and yet they don't want to speak French. They don't want their road signs in French. It just because of the connections to how the Tutsi were armed and by who. But it still, I think it hurts so much because it's so recent. And we're not old. None of us in this Zoom conference are old, but we have memories of this. And it's the fact that I think it's the reality that that humanity hasn't outgrown it. Still happens now. I think that's why Rwanda hurts the most. I don't know what you guys think.
I think certainly when we discuss... we sit in a very privileged position. We saw the Rwanda genocide often after the fact and over television screens. And I think certainly for individuals, I think we can certainly imagine A, who survived this, but B, individuals who even hear about this, for example, secondhand from parents and loved ones that did survive this and are wondering, of course, why they have no aunties or why they have no grandparents or why, for example, their mother doesn't speak about their father or why their father isn't present. Because, of course, we know one aspect of the Rwandan genocide was for one of the first times starts to become very public is the use of rape as a weapon of ethnic cleansing, or indeed as an act of a war crime. So why, for example, a mother doesn't speak about a child's father, or why, for example, maybe even their loved one who experienced the genocide even might still experience symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome. So that could range from anything from being uncomfortable from certain sounds, certain smells, certain images. It could range all the way up to potentially how, in relativity to how much of an impact these traumatic experience had, could even, for example, result in night terrors. A child maybe waking up in extreme cases to a parent screaming at night because the memory is still there of something that they experience. And this is what we call in trauma studies secondary trauma or inherited trauma. And it's been very well documented really since the Holocaust, since Jewish children of Holocaust survivors ask these questions of why their parents behave differently towards them or why their parents behave differently in general to people who did not experience this. So certainly the generation that are adults currently would be the second generation of survivors of the Rwandan genocide and would experience a whole host of witnessing certain psychological effects and then to a certain degree inheriting and adapting their own behaviors and psychology to the psychological effects of genocide from their parents.
I think my one, you mentioned the using rape. I think my one memory is that the Imperial War Museum did a thing in like the cinema that they had. I don't know if it's still there, what with the refurb and everything, but they showed a film of the genocide. And to her credit, my mum didn't stop me. She didn't want to go and watch it. I went and watched it. It was a 15-minute film. And the one thing I remember about that film, the one actual memory I have other than a blur of horror, is a small girl with her knickers around her ankles. And you just think, so in terms of film and genocide on film, she's lying on the floor, she's unconscious or she's dead. I don't know. And that's the situation she's been left in. And I wonder, why does Hollywood want to make films about this? And how do they go about it? How does it differ to any other normal kind of process of making a film?
Well, firstly, I think that of course, Hollywood does adapt in some way that a lot of media does to the idea that often the most horrific things are the ones that draw attention. And we see that, for example, in journalism, the most polarizing stories are the ones that that garner the most attention. So if we talk about, for example, like a clickbait culture, like the most shocking, the most polarizing, garners the most public attention. I think to a degree, it is that fascination with something shocking, with something terrible beyond comprehension that does attract viewers. So I'm certain that's one element of why Hollywood has picked up these films, and why actors such as Don Cheadle, such as Idris Elba, such as Liam Neeson, of course, from Schindler's List, also have been involved in these projects. But also, I think what we see particularly in the films that we're discussing today is often Hollywood picks out films that do, in the midst of this horror, have a happy ending in order to, of course, keep the viewer watching, in my opinion, through the entire film.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, it's like, why would you want to? But then, I mean, I'm sure this is going to come up because I think everyone lists Schindler's List as, no one lists it as a film they want to watch, but everyone lists it as a film they know they have to watch before they die. And I think there's an element, isn't there, of if you pretend these things didn't happen and you forget these things happened, then you risk them happening again.
A sort of social obligation, yeah.
You also picked, as you said, for Rwanda, Sometimes in April. Why the need, from an analytical perspective, why the need to pick both?
Well, I think Hotel Rwanda is as I said, also because it went through the Oscar cycle, et cetera, is by far the most famous depiction, especially for quote-unquote Western audiences, of the Rwandan genocide. I remember particularly... in my very early years, we're talking 12 years ago now, in my bachelor's degree, I remember that in my courses, my professor did not pick Hotel Rwanda as the film, as the required film to watch in my introduction to genocide course. Instead, it was Sometimes in April. And rewatching this, kind of analyzing Sometimes in April, what I find more valuable is, because it wasn't Hollywood per se, obviously it is popular mainstream filmmaking, I felt that Sometimes in April depicts a more honest version in some way. Hotel Rwanda, for various reasons, does pick and choose certain scenes that have the most dramatic impact. And I felt that Sometimes in April doesn't do that to a degree, but also, most importantly, in my opinion, shows an aftermath. It shows what someone is left with when they have lost everything, and to such a horrific extent as with the Rwandan genocide. I felt that Idris Elba's depiction of what someone is left with after that was so important to the story.
Alina, you found watching Sometimes in April some striking aspects of the film, didn't you?
Well, yeah. If we carry on with this line of thought, you kind of, when you watch it, he's trying to find out what happened to his wife and his kids, and that's the whole bottom line of the film. What happened to his wife and his kids? They go off with his brother, who is being prosecuted for crimes against humanity. He's in prison. And you're still trying to find out, by the end of the film, what happens to his wife and his sons. And it is such, I'm going to swear at this point, such a mind fuck at this point, that you have no idea. You're like, come on, she must have survived. She must have survived. And I'm not going to spoil the ending, because it's actually really interesting, the ending, how they write this whole, trying to find the right words to not make it sound, because it is, it's horrific what happens to her and the kids. and you just want to know. That is the one thing that drags on. And don't get me wrong, it's really interesting, but it's a total, it mind boggles you till the end.
I think, is that kind of the point though? Because how many people actually did get answers in Rwanda? Is that what the film is trying to say, maybe? That this is most people's fate?
They're not. Yeah. Like- and it's also about the trauma. You watch how, you know, it starts out with the rain in April, literally. And it's like the rain's come in April. It started all over again. The trauma is back. And it's repeated every year, same time of year. And that's what they underline through the whole film. That moment in April, the rains are back.
I think very much so. I find that this kind of motif that the film builds on, it very much reminds me of, you'll have to forgive me, I forget what the term is in English, but for Jewish people remembering the Holocaust, in German it's called the Jahrezeit. So it's the time of remembering every year, especially should Jewish individuals have family members who perished during the Holocaust, this particular period of remembrance. But also, I think very much so, yeah, it is very poignant with the Rwandan genocide that I imagine certain smells, the certain atmosphere that one can expect in Rwanda in the period of April could be a reminder, especially if this memory is so fresh, if we're dealing with 10, 15, 20 years after, sometimes even a smell, sometimes even the sound, sometimes even the humidity that would be created in such a climate from a rainy period could invoke, this is what I felt, this is what I smelled, this is what the humidity touching my skin felt like the last time I saw these people that I loved most alive. And I think that's something that very strikes me, this the title of Sometimes in April and that opening scene of Sometimes in April when the rain is coming back again. That's what strikes me. That's what I very much think about, is that is probably exactly what Idris Elba's character remembers the last time he saw the people that he loved the most alive.
Absolutely. You don't just look at the Rwanda genocide, and you've picked some films from others as well. So tell us about First They Killed My Father.
This is just so fresh in my mind because I just finished rewatching this. Like, it was the last thing I watched before I went to bed, just bring it back in my mind. First They Killed My Father is at this point, especially because of the director involved, which is Angelina Jolie, is probably the foremost depiction of the Cambodian genocide. Again, worth talking for Western audiences, mm-hmm. That exists today. So the Cambodian genocide took place from the mid to late 1970s and was very much a genocide that was targeted primarily against the intelligentsia. So persons from the cities, persons seen as more educated, and could be depicted as part of a sort of kind of communist agrarian revolution that was very much put forth by paramilitary groups in Cambodia during that period. And it is estimated today that 1.7 is the lower, and I stress estimate, up to 2 million victims were claimed during that period. And it follows the story of a young girl who first of all, is part of the evacuations of the capital city of Cambodia, Phnom Penh, very early on. So that would be April of 1975, and follows the story of her and then her family, and then when she separated from her family in a forced labor camp, an agrarian work camp in the Cambodian countryside, and then her experiences being trained as a child soldier, and then her experiences fleeing Cambodia as a refugee.
I still find this astounding that, you know, Holocaust happened in the 1940s and you've got genocide in the 1970s, in the 1990s. It's still happening today. it is just still happening today. And I can't wrap my head around how hard we work to let people know about what happened with the 6 million Jews, with the amounts of Poles and Soviets, and so many people who lost their lives in the Second World War, yet it's still going on.
I think it's something we don't learn. I mean, if one looks to certain genocide scholars, the argument of the first quote unquote recorded genocide can trace back to Julius Caesar and the conquest of Gaul.
We've had Emma Southern rant merrily about Caesar being a murdering scumbag on this podcast and saying he is responsible for genocide.
I mean, certainly it, genocide, of course, naturally is a modern term that came about after the Holocaust with Raphael Lemkin. But yeah, I mean, indeed, you have, as I said, certain scholars who would interpret the possibility of something like a genocide occurring in written history as far back as that. So humanity, I think, oddly enough, A, becomes desensitized, B, becomes disassociated with seeing certain groups as self, certain groups as something, as an entity, I should say, that can be recognized as something human, even, or something similar to them that has inherent value in terms of human life. And I think even with the media that exists today, with things like citizen journalism, with things like YouTube, cell phones, etc., certainly, again, I should stress in the Western world that certain people are not seen as humans. For example, the arguable genocide in Syria, if you ask the modern American if that was a genocide, if that was something that should be stopped, in my certain opinion, there would be a subset of American society, especially in the wake of 9/11, that would argue, no, this group is identifiable as people who support terrorist activity, who are arguable terrorists, and are a group of people that, because of the demonization in Western media, are no longer seen as human beings. And I think that is a consequence of propaganda throughout history as well. And we certainly can see it in every case of genocide that we're talking about today, if not every case of genocide, period.
Let's get to the one that coined the term then. We've already mentioned this. We've got a couple of films to talk about. One of them actually makes me angry. I'll explain why, but it's not Schindler's List. Schindler's List, it makes me angry for different reasons, and it's because it was allowed to happen. I guess we've talked about Sometimes in April and following one person's journey through genocide and looking at what it does to them. This is the benchmark, is it not, of the sweeping story that tells you the whole story of a genocide.
I'll say it. Schindler's List. Talk to us about Schindler. I'm going to keep quiet for this one.
Okay, because I was wondering if I should, of course, defer to you, Alana, as well. But
she'll definitely get her oar in eventually. Don't worry, but you're the guest. You go first.
Schindler's List was also one that I rewatched on Sunday, if I'm not mistaken, because of course, when I don't do other work, I just watch films regarding genocide. However, Schindler's List, I think, first of all, what strikes me is that it is black and white. It is very much Steven Spielberg's attempt to depict the, I think what we can safely say is the annihilation of the Jewish population in Poland, particularly the Jewish population in and surrounding Krakow, Poland. Schindler's List itself, I find, takes the monumentous task of trying to depict, indeed, the entire arc, the entire trajectory of the Jewish experience, particularly in, I would argue, a very heightened situation for the final solution to the Jewish question in Poland that takes place broadly between the invasion of Poland in 1939 up until the end of World War II, 1945. And I think Spielberg takes on a difficult task and does a commendable depiction in Hollywood cinema of trying to capture every element of the Jewish experience. So of course, going from the limitations of Jewish life that take place early on in Poland in 1935 to removal of property, of personal possessions, and the ghettoization that then takes place, the removal to forced labor camps that take place after that, and then of course deportation to one of the six death camps as well. And then of course, in the case of the quote unquote Schindler's Jews, that takes on a slightly different depiction. Of course, in the film, they're shown as being sent to Auschwitz. That is not the case in the case of the actual history of the Schindler's Jews. And then of course, of the ultimate liberation of Jewish persons at the end of the Nazi occupation. As I said, a monumentous task, a task that of course, when one is doing so in a very limited period of time, even though Schindler's List seems very long to certain audiences, is one that of course, given the fact that the Schindler's Jews survive, they live, unlike millions, as we know, roughly 6 million Jewish people, it has a certain, I would say, quote unquote, happy ending, not wishing to mitigate the traumatic experiences of any individual who survived that, yeah. Namely the Holocaust. It leaves out, of course, what happens to everyone else.
This is the thing, and this is where Alina comes in, because Alina's specialization is not Jews at Auschwitz, it's political prisoners and homosexuals, mm-hmm. and gypsies in inverted commas, and everyone else that the Nazis mm-hmm. murdered, isn't it, Alina?
Well, exactly. Look, I mean, if we're going to open up this can of worms, let's just open it up and spill the contents out. I am not against Schindler's List. I think what it did at the time is amazing, that it brought the Holocaust out into the light, because it didn't have an opportunity. People weren't talking about it. It started discussions. People were opening up. People were talking about their experiences. I'm not going to put that down for it, but it stretches the truth. And I'm not putting people's experiences out the window, because people went through some horrific, absolutely horrific things. And when I listened to some of the survivors talk about what happened and how Amon Gott would shoot from his balcony, and he narrowly missed the girl that he was shooting for and hit the person next to him. I mean, this stuff is just unbelievable. But Spielberg, again, he goes down the Hollywood route. He goes and shows specifically what happens at Płaszów. And Płaszów just wasn't for Jews. Płaszów, there were loads of Poles there. There were Poles being murdered in en masse up. If you go into Płaszów in I'm not going to get into the details, because otherwise I'll start planning Płaszów out and we don't have time for that. You know, there's this pits where Poles were being shot. It was also a labor camp, and it didn't actually become a concentration camp. I think, God, someone's going to correct me here, because I'm an Auschwitz historian, not a Płaszów historian. Is it 1943, 44? Someone's going to come in and correct me for that. Please do, if you have a moment. I prefer The Pianist. I'm going to go down that road. I'm going to say it out loud. I prefer The Pianist, because it shows you more of what life was like in the ghetto. Am I biased? Am I biased against Spielberg here? I think I might be.
I don't think you are.
A little bit biased.
It is your personal preference though, isn't it? And yes, you may be biased because that's your closer to your history. Than Schindler's List is, but if we're talking about if the one criticism you can make of Schindler's List is that it Hollywood divided a bit, that's a word now, Armand Goethe, then I have to say that I hate the principle of the boy in the striped pajamas.
I'm not even going to talk,
because
I just can't.
But why do you need to zhuzh up genocide and make it even sadder with something completely implausible?
Do you mean with the boy in striped pajamas?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you know what? I'll let Elizabeth go first, and then I will let my anger
out. It's her show. I'm not going to say any more than what I've said already. I think it's ick. I think zhuzhing up something as bad as the Holocaust to make it even sadder for your audience is pretty grim. I don't know. What do you think, Lizzie?
That is exactly why I brought it in.
Yay!
So if I have to kind of discuss what my preference is for Holocaust films, quite frankly, I feel that beyond Schindler's List is not my preference. I suppose I should say my, because I used to also work as a tour guide at the former concentration camp Sachsenhausen. So I had a lot of guests who would come in on my tours and would of course ask, well, where were the Jewish people kept? And that is 2 to possibly 6 barracks out of 60 plus, if I'm not mistaken, at what was a forced labor camp, not a death camp, not an extermination camp, not a camp in Poland, God forbid. So very much the narrative that could be captured is very limited to one group of people in Schindler's List. But I mean, even beyond that is even limited in terms of the narrative of Jewish victims of the Holocaust. And I really feel that the only narrative that does that justice is the 12-hour long saga of Shoah. So I think when we talk about the scale of the Holocaust, when we talk about minimum in my opinion, having researched the Holocaust, 11 million people, and that of course is a hugely questionable number, and I would argue it's much more, that really, if we just talk about the one subset of victims of the Holocaust, Shoah barely does it justice. So we're talking then 12 hours versus the 3-ish hours of Schindler's List. When we talk about the boy in striped pajamas, from my background in the United States, that's where I grew up. That is where I got my early history education, as very flawed as that is in many aspects. Personally, my experience was that The Boy in Striped Pajamas was a book that was used by teachers in secondary school that wanted to cover this material, but this is, of course, as it is a children's book.
Yeah, commendable idea as a book, as a film.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Also more horrendous. Yeah. But based on the book, it is for a very specific age range. And I understand that for children, I can empathize that for children, the concept is to show empathy and humanity in a situation where you're not supposed to be able to empathize, make friends with a group of people that is so completely demonized. That is a wonderful narrative for a child, and very much cannot capture the totality of the dehumanization that took place and the very calculated, planned dehumanization of the Jewish people that started long before the National Socialist Party, the Nazi Party, even came into existence in Germany. Of course, we know that Jewish people have been discriminated, at least in my country, in Germany, since the early Middle Ages. They are forced to identify themselves differently. They, of course, in the Middle Ages, are restricted to certain professions. And this is very well known, that Jewish people are something considered other, are something considered inherently un-German, especially when we start to have the definition of what it means to be a citizen of Germany that comes about in the Second Reich. So of course we all know the Third Reich, the Nazi period, the Second Reich, also known as the Iron Empire, was of course the period where we have Kaisers. So Kaiser Wilhelm II, the famous Wilhelm scream that we know in films is named after him.
Yeah, we love it. He's my speciality is World War One, and in particular George V in World War One. So Willie and I are old friends.
Well, cousins of everyone.
Yeah.
But what I find so sad about poor Wilhelm is, of course, he doesn't look like George Nicholas.
No, I know. Well, unless
not the identical twin
film, but yeah, he didn't look like anything like, I think, the kind of man that he wanted to be with
definitely
his identity, and stuff. And I think it was largely the root of the problem. But he wasn't guilty of genocide, so let's put him out of the conversation.
Well, was he? The genocide of the Herero and Nama would have taken place.
On his watch.
Yeah. So he is, but again, against people that Western audiences definitely don't identify as self or a group of people even considered human at that period.
I think overshadowed completely by Leopold as well.
Yes, definitely, of course, with the occurrences in the Congo that never stopped having an impact, of course, with conflict minerals, with child soldiers, with paramilitary groups. Oh, the list goes on in the Congo. Sorry, I digress. We were talking about...
We digress all the time on History Hack. It's fine.
We're talking about the boy in the striped pyjamas.
And why it's okay as a story for children, but why I think you're about to get to why it's really not okay for grown-ups.
I will say, as an introduction to this, I mean, certainly what it does is... it belittles the, first of all, the depictions that children in Nazi Germany would have had about Jewish people. So the idea that, of course, the main character, Bruno, would not have been in the Hitler Youth, would not have been told what we now would identify today, absolutely horrific things of how they should view individuals that, because children were told that these individuals must be removed from society. They were told that these individuals, for the safety of German people, must be removed. That even a boy of his age would not have had some cognizance of that narrative is unfortunately completely false, to the degree that a child would then be able to recognize that in their daily life. Yes, naturally that's questionable. I even, in my research on trauma and specializing to some degree in the impact of trauma on children, would not be able to psychologically speak to the degree in which a child would be impacted by such rhetoric specifically.
But the idea that he'd be clueless is just doesn't wash with you.
No. And certainly the idea that then in addition, because the depiction is assumed to be Auschwitz, that a child would be able to get up to the fence is not in any way, shape, or form at all plausible.
It's not even like you're sitting there going, but the buttons are wrong, like pedants. It's the fact that it belittles what Auschwitz was. Go on, Elena. Go on, rip.
I'm so dying to rip this a new one. So it's perceived that he was, going down the Auschwitz route, that he was Huss's child in theory, because who else was the camp commandant at that point? Jesus. First of all, they lived in their little villa, you know, secluded. The only contact they would have had with prisoners would have been, you know, the nanny or the prisoner that came to clean the house or whoever it was. Or, for example, one of the first transport would go and cut Hearst's hair and his son's hair. That's the only contact they would have had with prisoners. They would not have had contact with children. Children predominantly in Birkenau. And if you look at the bloody distance between the two, how would he have gone and seen them? It just would not have happened. It just would not have happened. It's impossible. And the other thing is, do you know the amount of people that ask me, where did this happen? Where did the, you know... And I'm thinking that it's fiction, people. It just didn't happen. And I'm getting really rattled up
Take a deep breath, Alina. I think what we're saying, rather than picking out every historical inaccuracy with the boy in the striped pajamas, is that it's an unnecessary addition to the lexicon of Holocaust and genocidal films. Is that what the grown-up versions of us were saying?
No, I view this film exactly the way I view the tattooist of Auschwitz, the librarian of Auschwitz. It is the same, okay? Based on some sort of truth somewhere, somehow, but made up or exaggerated all the way around. That's how I view them. Sorry to people who've been reading these books. They're just, it's trash. It's all trash.
I just find it ick that it would be a fashionable setting for a love story. Let's move away from the Holocaust and the striped pyjamas before we all lose our shit completely. Because we have two more. And actually, I really... let's get the one I watched the other night out of the way first, because I'm really keen to hear what you've got to say about the last one. But Dances with Wolves, I watched it the other night, and we're talking about the decimation of the Indian population or Native American population in America. And I started off, because I haven't seen it in, so I think the story is my mum has made me at some point in my young life made me sit through all of these films as they were coming out and as they were coming out on video, because she was obsessed with Kevin Costner. And at the point where they skinned the buffalo, I stopped watching and felt sick and never went back. So I sat through it all, or they found skinned buffalo and I was done. But it started off, and I didn't realize that there was going to end up being, in Hollywood parlance, a good tribe and a bad tribe. So it was, you got all this glorious music and sweeping score when he was traipsing across Colorado and Ohio. And then the Native Americans showed up to the baddie music. But then I was not giving it time to bed in, because obviously then he goes and meets the Sioux, doesn't he? And it completely changes his life. And he's not a real character, but what does this film do for this genocide?
Well, I think first of all, Dances with Wolves is a film that I inherently kind of wanted to bring into this discussion. Because of course, again, with the name Kevin Costner attached to it, is one of the most famous depictions of Plains Indians groups. And of course, with the Sioux, there is multiple groups, or people would call them tribes, of the Sioux that exist even today. And what Dances with Wolves propagates, one of its great downfalls, is the idea of the Plains Indians as, first of all, a group of people that is nomadic, which we associate very stereotypically with Native American groups, that they're all nomadic, that they all live on horseback, and that they are a hunter society. First of all, what this does is it typifies the popular beliefs about Native American peoples, that the idea that they fit into the certain stereotype, and in my mind, very much belittles the idea that there was an empire of Plains Indians peoples, that this was a highly sophisticated society, that this was a society that was conquering, that was actually, like we would assume European people to be, they were colonizing, they were taking over new territories. And the idea that we belittle Native Americans peoples, or in Canada, First Nations peoples, as a group of people that is only to be conquered and not the conquerors, first of all, is something that this film can open up discussion for. But also, what Dances with Wolves depicts is something that really was made clear to me when I worked for a short period of time on a couple of projects with the Canadian Embassy in Germany, is that the popular depiction, maybe not in the United States, maybe not even in the United Kingdom, but around the world, is that there are, for example, German people that would still ask representatives of the Canadian Embassy if Native Americans, or in the Canadian case, First Nations people, still lived in teepees. That the idea that this is a group of people that was sort of frozen in time, and that this is a group of people that the film, certainly Dances with Wolves, would even depict that doesn't exist anymore. that there isn't a very long and also a very genocidal and traumatic history that occurs after Dances with Wolves takes place that begs discussion and that has been...
I won't lie, I lost track of how long it was. And at the point where he rides out of the pass at the end, I was stunned that was the end of the film. And then it reeled up. 13 years later, they got run away and that was it. And the Sioux died.
Yeah.
And I was like, hang on, what? So what is this film been about? Where this? Okay, so he's leaving. I get that. But then surely this is the intermission? I don't know. I just felt like, what is the point? Where was this going? What were you trying to convey with this story? And then I realized it was Kevin Costner, and actually what they were trying to convey was as much Kevin Costner on screen, because he directed it as well, as possible. And when you tie that in with his performance in the editing suite of Robin and Prince of Thieves, which was like in a chronological line quite close, where he shut the director out of the editing suite so he could edit it with himself in it more, because he thought people were stealing his thunder. It's just a vanity fest for Kevin Costner, is it not?
And it's also very much whitewashing the Native American narrative, in that, of course, yes, the person to be depicted, the story to be told in the relationship between Anglo-European settlers in the Plains region of the United States and Native American peoples is meant to be told from the perspective of Anglo-European settlers and not from Native American / First Nations peoples themselves. And I think in that trope, Kevin Costner does a huge disjustice to that narrative, and sadly only propagates what has been the narrative of that group of peoples and how that narrative has been told since the 1700s.
It is, I mean, because it's all about him. And in doing that, what he's actually doing in microcosm, he is just white people. It's all about us and our perception of Native Americans and what happened, and not them. I think the idea that they were kind of, I don't know, or what, am I just reading too much into it, that they come across as really childlike, and then as soon as they give the white man a chance, they realize he's great and they all want to be his friend, and they all want to wear his clothes, and one of them wants his hat and the other one wants his jacket. And I'm thinking,
no, that is a narrative that we see repeated again and again and again in how Anglo-European peoples depict First Nations / Native American peoples. And something that, again, why I felt Dances with Wolves was an essential part of this narrative is because we see in the epilogue at the end of the film that the Sioux people are quote unquote broken. This, of course, is also not in name, but is referencing the Wounded Knee Massacre, which was December 29th, 1890. And then, of course, what happens after that, which is the period of, the Native American version of ghettoization, which is reservationism. Very soon after the quote-unquote, and this is what the United States government termed as the pacification of Plains Indian peoples, what this begins to, in order to re-educate and assimilate the childlike Plains Indian peoples, is the period of residential schools. And this is the forced removal of Indigenous children, Indigenous with a lowercase I, because Indigenous children with a capital I has a different connotation, but the forcible removal of Indigenous children away from reservations, because reservations were essentially a place for Indigenous peoples to die, that culture to die, and adult Indigenous peoples to die. The idea is that children are removed. Children are re-educated. They're taught to cast off their childlike primitive ways and become Westernized. And this is what we now know today as the residential school system. The residential school system, as we'll talk about in a little bit, is something very, very, very well known in Australian history. For a couple of reasons, is somewhat well known in Canadian history and is all but not discussed in United States history, even though the first residential school, the first school where Indigenous First Nations, Native American children are removed and put to was opened up in the United States in the state of Pennsylvania and is known as the Carlisle School.
It just, so what we're saying is that basically that Kevin Costner's a knob, which I kind of, I mean, I slightly less offensive than Mel Gibson, I think, but that's a whole other podcast. Apocalypto didn't make it onto your list. She's shaking her head like, hell no, it didn't. I just, yeah. It's Alina, for your benefit, because you didn't, this was one of the ones I did. You spend 3.5 hours as this guy leaves the American Civil War, goes across the plains and decides that life is better as a Native American, grows his hair long, marries the one convenient white woman that happens to live / translate for everybody in the camp. Lizzie's getting angry just on this recap. And then basically the American army catches up with them and then they kill a load of them. And then he decides he's leaving. So he rides off into the sunset. And it's like, what? But what's this got to do? I'm not interested in you, Kevin. It's not all about you. I'm interested in the Sioux people. And you've just cut the film off. And then suddenly it comes up on the screen. 13 years after this, this happened. And then the Sioux were destroyed. And you're like, okay, so that was basically a 4-hour film and you ran out of budget or what?
You know what this sounds similar to? Not exactly, but similar. Wait for this one. The Last Samurai.
Oh, which is obviously all about Tom Cruise.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's just like.
And also greatly mischaracterizes the end of samurai culture and what the samurai culture represented. And the fact that samurai culture is simply adapted with the so called period of industrialization in Japan to
realize that machine guns were awesome. She's having heart palpitations. Let's go. Right, let's go to Australia. She's not going to make her any less angry because you mentioned residential schools and forcible removal of children. Now, I have not seen this film. I want to see it. I think I started watching it once and fell asleep. And that's not a reflection of the film. I think it was just like 3 o'clock in the morning. It's Kenneth Branagh and Rabbit Proof Fence is about Aborigines or Native Australian Indigenous. Oh, my God, I get so confused with the terms and offending people. Aboriginal Australians is what it talks about and what white people did to them. So what does this tell us?
So the Rabbit Proof Fence is a specific depiction of two young girls who are removed from the region of Western Australia, getting more towards Central Australia. So Western Australia for anyone who has been, of course, the portion that we think of to visit or is widely populated is of course Perth and Fremantle, and then going down towards South Australia. Largely Western Australia has its most settlement and its most kind of like urban areas along the coast, as a lot of Australia does. And Western Australia of course even to this day still has one of the largest proportions of Aboriginal peoples with a capital A in the whole of Australia. And very much so because of the high percentage at the turn of the 20th century, so the turn of the 1900s. Yes, that is the 20th century. I always get confused with that. Even historians do. But anyway, turn of the 1900s, because Western Australia has proportionally the highest level of Aboriginal peoples, there is a man who is put in charge of Aboriginal affairs called A.O. Neville, who is played in the film by Kenneth Branagh, which I think is it's a depiction that turns your stomach. But Kenneth Branagh, I find, does an amazing depiction of A.O. Neville. There's one scene I want to talk about in a minute. He depicts very much the mindset, the governmental policies towards Aboriginal people that not only translates to forcible removal of children, what we now term today, particularly as the stolen generations, and the process of re-education of Aboriginal peoples. In Western Australia, A.O. Neville cultivates a particular policy that goes one step further than especially the rest of Australia, but also even Canada, who has a concurrent policy of removal and of Indigenous assimilation at the same time. And that is what is called racial absorption. So one particular scene that is depicted, in my opinion, brilliantly by Kenneth Branagh is a scene in which he is showing a slideshow of what we call half castes, quadroons, and octoroons. This is a horrific term for the idea that it is widely believed in, even today, as much as it has a different connotation, believed that indigeneity, as far as Australian Aboriginal indigeneity, is a recessive trait. So the idea that facial features, skin color, et cetera, in terms of Australian Aborigines is a recessive trait, that if you force, and this is the case, force young Aboriginal girls who are white looking, and you forcibly marry them, and A.O. Neville actually had the control to say, you may marry this person, you may not marry this person, you are told to marry this person. Essentially, and it is termed in the film, breed out the black. This was actually a governmental policy in Western Australia to racially absorb Aboriginal people by, first of all, removing them from their parents, secondly, putting them into residential schools, and thirdly, because the total control of an Aboriginal person to the age of 18 would be under the control, particularly of A.O. Neville, the character that Kenneth Branagh plays in the film, meant that he could personally engineer the racial absorption of Aboriginal peoples.
Oh, I feel sick. I feel fucking sick.
Welcome to my entire master's thesis.
Yeah, is this what you did your master's?
This is what I did my master's thesis on, was the residential school system in Canada and Australia.
You know, I think we need to start heading our own films, and we can run our own TV series at this rate, because at least we'll get it done properly.
Probably won't be worth watching to anybody that's a layman, because they'll just be like, where's the plot line? Where's the happy ending? Well, there isn't one, and we taught you a lesson. Now go away. I know Rabbit Proof Fence. Are there any other films that sort of challenge this or do it in a different way?
In my mind, as far as narrative film depictions, The Rabbit Proof Fence, and of course, this is the story of Doris Pilkington, by far is the most famous depiction. I've had many Australians, when I've kind of slid in to the topic of genocide with many of my Australian guests previously, that is by far the one depiction of the quote unquote stolen generations, this entire process, it often tends to be talked about among people who are Australian, who live in Australia, and are particularly are of the white, the Anglo-European settler population of Australia. So I would say that this film is in a category of its own as far as the Australian cultural consciousness. There are several documentaries, particularly in my mind, I always tend to like the long, very harrowing, probably like Alana, in that the depictions that I feel do this history best tend to be the longest ones possible. So there's one documentary that I watched probably over and over again, even when it was not what was going into my research, was The First Australians. And that is an amazing, it's an 8-part documentary, of each episode being 45 to 50 minutes long. But really, I do feel that's the best. In my opinion, what comes out the most often in terms of Aboriginal storytelling from Australia about this period tends to be coming in the form of songs, coming in the forms of then these songs and these poems being put into written form. That tends to be what I see most often. We're also seeing a lot of documentary films that deal with the aftermath of the Stolen Generation, the traumatic impact of the Stolen Generation, which of course involves criminality. So alcoholism, then public, what do we call public offenses based on alcoholism, petty crime, undereducation, lack of education. There's a lot of documentaries that are talking about that these days. And then also what very much is starting to come about is the discussion of the absolute severance that the residential school system tried to achieve, and to a large degree did achieve in Australia, was the total severance from culture, from language, from cultural practices, from family and family systems that occurs in Australia as well. So very much, I think if one wants an accurate depiction and one can kind of has some sort of background knowledge in, okay, the Stolen Generations happened, it existed, this is the rough narrative, and then a consciousness of this impacts Aboriginal life today. I very much would err towards modern documentaries, and several have gone to like Sundance and major international film festivals that discuss this, and I think do a really fantastic job. But that kind of, it skips, doesn't it, for a lot of people. It skips Stolen Generation narrative, removal narrative, and then kind of skips to the modern day and kind of forgets everything that happens in between. So that can be quite hard for some viewers as well, in my opinion.
Lizzie, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about genocide on film. This has been so interesting. We're both really into films, and we're both renowned for researching miserable topics as well. And we found another friend. Yay! Brilliant. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's as I said, been something I've looked forward to talking about for a while. So it's been great to find kindred nerds.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.